This is the time set for the third case for argument today on the Southern Panels docket, case number 75208, Christopher Anderson versus District Court, Real Party in Interest, City of Las Vegas. Council, ready to proceed?
Yes, we are.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael Pariente. My last name is spelled P-A-R-I-E-N-T-E. My bar number is 9469. And if I could please ask for 3 minutes reserved for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel Ms. Herbert and Mr. Reaney, along with co-counsel Mr. Watkins and Mr. Keel. This case involves Mr. Anderson's Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. Now, his case is the corollary to Amezcua. However, unlike Amezcua, Anderson's permanent loss of his Second Amendment right is a direct consequence of Nevada's 2015 law. The legislation takes away a person's Second Amendment right upon conviction for a misdemeanor crime of battery domestic violence. The effect of the law is automatic and immediate as well as it is permanent. The Second Amendment is a fundamental right. It's an important one. The Second Amendment also, it's so important that ratification of the United States Constitution was based on the understanding that a Bill of Rights would be forthcoming. The Second Amendment is one of the 10 Bill of Rights. The Second Amendment applies to the citizens of the states through the 14th Amendment, and any argument that the permanent loss of a person's Second Amendment right is not serious, that argument lacks merit. Now, this court in Amezcua held that the loss, if it occurred, was collateral and not direct because the Nevada legislature had not made Second Amendment abrogation a consequence of the misdemeanor conviction for battery domestic violence. But this has changed. The new legislation enacted by the Nevada legislature determines that people who've been convicted of battery domestic violence forever lose their Second Amendment right. And again, the effect is automatic and immediate as well as permanent. Now, since this loss of the Second Amendment is a direct consequence of a conviction for battery domestic violence pursuant to Amezcua, Mr. Anderson now has a constitutional right to a jury, and his request for relief must be granted.
Have you found any other state that has found exactly on this issue?
On the Second Amendment issue,
right.
I have not, Your Honor.
Because there's got to be other states that have obviously adopted a very similar, you know, not the federal counterpart, but now they duplicate and they do their own state statute like what we did here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Has any other state ruled on this type of issue before that the jury trial right attaches? Because of the Second Amendment loss in battery DV cases.
And Your Honor, I didn't spend really hardly any. I quoted one case. It was a federal case that referenced where a magistrate said a lifelong loss of the Second Amendment right is an additional penalty viewed together with a maximum term of imprisonment that makes it a serious offense, entitling one to a jury trial. But because Amezcua is so limited, and Blanton and Amezcua say you have to just look at what the legislature did. You can't look at what other states did to determine if it's serious. You've got to look at what the Nevada legislature did. And because of that, my focus has been purely on Amezcua and asking this court to follow Amezcua.
Well, but to follow on to Justice Silver's question, there is a distinction, as you pointed out in your argument, between what a state has done with its own statute in this context. So to pose the question, the same question in a slightly different way, have you canvassed other states in the country where they have adopted a state statute that imposes the same restriction or limitation or deprives the defendant of access to firearms permanently upon conviction of a domestic battery charge?
Your Honor, I have not, again, I haven't found cases where, and probably the reason why, Your Honor, quite frankly, is because my understanding is that 46 states allow jury trials for misdemeanors in some form or fashion. For instance, Arizona has jury trials for crimes of moral turpitude, such as battery constituting domestic violence. So really, we, along with New Jersey, Louisiana, and Mississippi, I believe are the only states that do not allow jury trials. So I have not...
For misdemeanors?
For misdemeanors, I'm sorry, for misdemeanors, yeah, where the maximum term is over 6 months.
Right.
So I don't, looking at those four states, I haven't had a chance to look to see. Because, again, my focus was on Amezcua and how the Nevada legislature, and because we're told in footnote 8 of Blanton, we're told that we're only to look at what, in making the seriousness analysis, we're told only to look at what Nevada did. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've done.
What about in Blanton? I mean, it goes on and on about the quote, talking about the outlying communities due to demographic and economic realities. It goes on and talking about how, you know, we have some jurisdictions that the JPs or the Munich, they don't even have any, of course. The JPs are, back when, they're farmers half the time, and then they go sit sometimes. It's not as if they can call in 1,000 jurors like the 8th Judicial. I mean, shouldn't we be concerned with the policy considerations and Blanchard as far as this type of case goes?
And respectfully, Your Honor, I would say no, because we're talking about a Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. It's a constitutional right. And so when it's a constitutional right, it's not good enough to say, well, the JP down in Gene or wherever, you know, is not an attorney and they are not set up to hear, you know, jury trials. That's not an excuse. Financial limitations have their limitations in an analysis such as this.
So we should disregard their policy dicta from Blanton. Blanton, sorry.
Because we're talking about a constitutional right. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, there's nothing in this record that indicates that there's some pragmatic or financial constraint to the exercise of jury trials, is there?
Well, Judge, Justice, if I could just clarify, we're talking about a very narrow application. If you want it, obviously you want me to address the financial aspects of it, as Justice Silver has
brought. Well, no, I don't want to go outside the record. I'm asking you a very focused question. Is there anything in this record that says that there's going to be severe financial constraints or the rural counties can't do something that the urban counties can do? Is there anything in this record supports any kind of a conclusion like that?
No, Your Honor.
So the commentary or the dicta in Blanton, even that lacks support, I think, in that case. But certainly there's nothing like that in this case.
Correct, Your Honor, when that's not an issue that we focused on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Justice Stiglitz, were you going to ask questions? Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Herbert, how are you today?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Carlene Halbert. I'm appearing for the City of Las Vegas. The amendment of NRS 202-360A did not create any additional restrictions for the petitioner. Although the statute might be new, the consequences have remained the same. We are here today because of a distinction without a difference. The purpose of amending Nevada's prohibited person statute was not to create misdemeanor jury trials or to make a determination about the seriousness of first offense domestic battery.
What was its purpose then?
The purpose was to come into accordance with federal law, to close the felony loophole, and to protect victims from escalating recidivism. That is apparent on the face of the statute and the legislative history.
But there, you already have a federal statute out there. I mean, anybody caught with a gun after a DV conviction can be federally charged. And back when I was doing it, it could be like a minimum of 5. So there is no true loophole because this punishment is like a 1-6. So my question to you, if this isn't a serious offense, what is? Tell me what misdemeanor would be considered serious under the United States Supreme Court.
I would agree with you, Your Honor, that 202-360A, prohibited persons, is absolutely a serious offense. That is entitled to a jury trial. That is a Category B felony. That is crystal clear. I don't think that the amendment of 202-360 shows a clear legislative determination that first offense battery domestic violence is now a serious offense.
It makes it more serious because it takes, I mean, now it's making the next time you do it an enhanceable offense. So my question to you is, there's a distinction between petty and serious offenses. What offense would you say is serious that would warrant a jury trial if it's not this?
I would say, well, obviously, any charge where there's more than a six-month incarceration period. And again, in any misdemeanor where there's been a clear legislative determination that that offense is serious. And I don't think the petitioner can meet his burden of showing that when NRS 202-360 was amended, that somehow translates into a clear legislative determination that this other statute in this completely separate chapter of the NRS is now a serious offense. If they had wanted to make first offense battery domestic violence a serious offense, they had, you know, a lot of options to choose from. They could have increased the incarceration time. They could have plainly stated that this is a serious offense. Jury trials are a good attach. They could have made it a gross misdemeanor. They didn't do any of those things.
So you're saying there's just a bright line rule. That's it. If it's over 6 months, then you get a jury trial. But that's not really what the case law says. It makes that distinction between serious and petty.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is no bright line rule at the six-month mark. But the petitioner does need to show, it's his burden to show, that the additional penalties show a clear legislative determination that the offense is serious. And I think that the United States Supreme Court was purposeful in adopting that clear legislative phrase, particularly because of the concerns laid out in Blanton. Again, as you noted, Blanton laid out a lot of concerns about the administrative and economic hardships that would have to occur.
But there's nothing in this record that does that, is there?
There's not. But the law has acknowledged that those concerns exist. And in fact, when the United Supreme Court...
Well, there was some dicta in that case. I don't know how well supported that was in that record either. Have you looked at that appendix in that case? Does that appendix support the commentary that's contained in that decision?
No, Your Honor, I have not looked at that appendix. I do not have access to
that. But there's nothing in this record that addresses that, is there?
No, there's not. But Blanton is binding precedent as far as what was stated in there.
Dicta in a case is not binding precedent. You would agree with that?
I would agree with you, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I didn't mean to misstate that.
It's all right. I understand.
I do believe that the United States Supreme Court relied upon that dicta and that concerns when they identified that it is incumbent upon the legislature to determine the seriousness of offense. And they identified that it's that the legislature should, in fact, handle it because they're in a better position to do so. And then they made that determination that it needs to be a clear legislative determination. I don't think there can be an accidental determination. The legislature.
Are we resolving this case under the United States constitutional protections to a jury trial, or should we consider the Nevada Constitution's right to a jury trial in resolving this case?
I think they're inherently the same, but I would say the Nevada Constitution.
So you would agree that our decision, once decided, would take into consideration both constitutional provisions, rights to a jury trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good.
And just speaking briefly to the Constitution, again, what's interesting, too, is the recent, you know, ratification of the Nevada Constitution to incorporate Article 1AA, which is the Victim's Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And again, with all the concerns laid out in Blanton, essentially what's going to happen is that thousands of cases are going to remain at a standstill because by statute, prosecutors cannot plea bargain these cases. And so we need to allocate funding, construction needs to be completed, and we need to adopt procedures for summons in jurors and stuff like that.
But that hasn't been briefed in this case.
It's not. You've mentioned the Nevada Constitution, so I
yeah.
With that, but I would acknowledge it was not briefed.
Mm-hmm. But wouldn't the Nevada constitutional amendment concerning Marcy's law impact our analysis here?
I think that it should. I think that if you were to find that misdemeanor jury trials should be enacted, it would sort of put it at odds with Marcy's law at this point.
Well, maybe not. There might be some fiscal consequences or some scheduling consequences, but I don't know that it necessarily is at odds to the finding of a jury trial if we determine that the deprivation of one's Second Amendment rights are permanent and expose the defendant to a Category B felony.
And I would agree with that to a certain extent. With the specific provision of Marcy's law, it does entitle a victim the timely disposition following an arrest.
Sure.
And so that would have some consequences. But I do agree with you. But I would like to point out that although petitioner indicates that it's a lifetime restriction, you are entitled to seal your records 7 years after the case has been closed.
That doesn't restore your firearm rights.
I'm sorry?
A sealing of the record doesn't restore your firearm,
you
right?
You can petition to reinstate your
firearm. And now that you're going outside the record, how many of those are granted in Muni Court?
We are actually, we just essentially...
I mean, you're going out of the record, so now I'm going to go out of the record and say, I haven't seen one.
No, we have a policy in place to stipulate to anybody that can have their record sealed does have their record sealed. It has happened, I will acknowledge, it's been in the past 2 years that we've really taken an action to do that.
Well, but since we're all sort of rolling around, the record, I think we might want to bring us back into the record, but we've had this come up in the Pardons Board fairly frequently, where people who've served their sentences come back and seek a pardon, and the pardon asks that they be pardoned for their offense and seek restoration of their civil rights, and then separately, restoration of their rights to bear arms. And that comes up fairly often in the Pardons Board considerations of DV cases, DV convictions. In that context, the role or relevance or impact or consequences of a sealing records order frequently comes up. Seems like these convictions still are floating around on these people's records even after a sealing order. In any event, let's come back to this case. Justice Stiglitz has a question or two.
Thank you, Mrs. Hersey. How do we, you essentially have argued that it's not a direct consequence, but how do we harmonize that with Amescua, which in part relied upon the fact that it was collateral because it was a federal, different sovereign, but your rights to a firearm after the new legislation are stripped upon conviction. Why isn't that a direct consequence at that? It doesn't depend on any future conduct. At that moment, your rights are stripped. How do we distinguish that?
Well, I don't think that MESCU was necessarily dispositive in whether or not the state would enact it. It would automatically become a direct consequence.
Well, but certainly we relied upon the fact that it was, we said, collateral.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
Our legislature hasn't spoken. It seems now they've spoken.
Yes, but yes, that's true. Again, I would submit that, again, when a legislature enacts an amendment to one statute in 202-360, I don't think that necessarily translates to a seriousness determination in another statute, especially when there's a precise overlap of the federal and state restrictions.
But then we never needed to, they didn't need to do it at all. Like you keep saying, it's a distinction without a difference in one direction. But the other way, there's all kinds of reasons to do it.
Well, I think the state has an absolute public interest in protecting victims from escalating recidivism. And they can't prosecute. That's up to the federal government. And they can choose which cases they want to do, whereas the state does not have that luxury.
But I'm a bit confused, if I could follow up.
Please.
How does affording a defendant a right to a jury trial impair the state's interest in protecting DV victims from future harm? I don't understand that. Is there anything in this record that connects those two concepts?
No, I don't think that it does. But the purpose of 202-368, the purpose of that amendment was to prevent escalating recidivism, not to determine that 200.485 was a serious offense.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in speaking with Amescua, you know, I think what's inherent in Amescua is that a firearm restriction can occur without a jury trial. Amescua requested a jury trial and was denied. He was subsequently convicted, and in his first offense, battery domestic violence, and in his petition to this court, he claimed, among other things, that he was now prohibited from owning a firearm, and that he should have been afforded a jury trial. And this court found that although he might be subject to a loss of firearms under 18 U.S.C. 922G, it was a collateral consequence. But the court inherently acknowledged that that prohibition could be in existence without a jury trial. Otherwise, the issue would have been moot. There would have been no need to determine whether or not it was a collateral consequence. And so then the legislature relied upon that finding and said, okay, he can be prosecuted under 18 U.S.C. 922G. Let's take that statute and let's put it in the Nevada Revised Statutes, word for word. And again, that has a very specific definition, too, that says misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. That has a specific definition under federal law and applies to a very limited class of defendants. And so if our legislature had wanted to expand that restriction, they could have adopted NRS 33.018, which is our domestic violence definition.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, in Battery Thirds, right, the prosecutors over on the other side of the aisle, the county, go to jury trial all the time on Battery Thirds, and they present exactly what you present in municipal court, which is a DV trap. And then, of course, the district court judge at sentencing determines whether or not they've met the enhanceability. Here, they get a jury trial for that, for the underlying offense. Here, you're talking about no jury trial, and at the end, as Justice Stiglitz said, at the end of it, you're deprived your constitutional right. If you can give a jury trial under enhanced penalties, what stops jury trials when you're dealing with the loss of a constitutional right here?
Well, I think that the difference is that the battery domestic third is based upon an inherent recidivism. And so once you, you know, are charged with it...
Isn't it just as dangerous? That's the whole point of the enhanceability of the statute, is not to have a gun for recidivism.
Yes, again, but that's under 202.360 and not under 200.485. And so again, I don't think if anything, I think the legislature relied upon the Mexico and said, hey, we can take this restriction, we can put it under state law, and we should be okay. You know, otherwise they might have said, hey, we're going to enact this amendment, we don't know that it's going to cause any impact on this separate statute in this separate chapter. And if it's sort of an accidental consequence, then there's a lack of clear legislative determination. And that's petitioner's job to show that clear legislative determination that it is now a serious offense. In his brief, I know petitioner also argues that the inclusion of domestic battery offenders along with the mentally ill entitles him to a jury trial as well. Again, I would say that a person does not need to commit a crime, let alone a serious crime, to be committed. Those are usually done in front of a special hearing master and do not require a jury trial. And again, under that rationale, anybody could be entitled to a jury trial because of this, you know, talismanic penalty that converts, you know, a firearm restriction. So if somebody came in to a littering charge and pled guilty but mentally ill, under petitioner's rationale, they now get a jury trial.
But what would be wrong with a jury trial? What's the inherent problem with affording constitutional protections or protections of a jury of their peers before they're convicted of an offense as opposed to a judge? What's the inherent problem with that? Whether you're entitled to or not, what's the...
I don't think that there is an inherent problem with that at all, mm-hmm. Justice. I think that the law, though, as it stands, is that it's presumed a petty offense, and under Nevada Constitution and U.S. Constitution, petty offenses are not entitled to a jury trial, and unless the petitioner can overcome his burden, it should remain within our purview to essentially keep a bench trial.
Do you believe it was within the purview of the district judge to grant a jury trial?
No, absolutely not. I think, especially, I believe it's Donahue versus Sparks, they need an express grant of authority from this court to do that. And just on a final note, because I'm running out of time here, but I would like to note that in under 200.485, a defendant is still allowed to serve any time of custody intermittently. And in Amescua, this court specifically found that as a view that the legislature did not treat that as a serious offense. And that provision still is in existence today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
If I could just respond, what it comes down to is this, and I'll just be very blunt, of course I don't mean any disrespect to opposing counsel, but they're asking you to live in pretend land, some sort of fantasy land, where this automatic and immediate abrogation of a person's Second Amendment right upon conviction for battery domestic violence, they want you to think that that's collateral, because that's what this comes down to. If you look at Amescua, if it's direct, if it's a direct consequence, it's a clear reflection by the Nevada legislature to treat it as a serious offense. The Nevada legislature says we can't look at collateral consequences to determine if the legislature has treated it as a serious offense. Mr. Herbert says that if there's a presumption we haven't overcome, of course we've overcome, because this is the only misdemeanor on the books in Nevada where you lose a constitutional right. In fact, there are gross misdemeanors you can be convicted of where you don't lose a constitutional right. You're talking about the additional penalties. If we just apply a simple application is all we're looking for at Amescua. The additional penalties here, the permanent, lifelong deprivation of your Second Amendment right. And Justice Silver is correct. You don't get to, just because you seal it, and as I believe you referred to, Justice Hardy, just because you seal it, the loss is still gone. And there's a statute directly on point that states that when someone's record, and I think it's, I have to get the statute, it's 2017, it's the record sealing statute. It says that the order says that you do not get your Second Amendment right back. That's lost. You may seal your record after 7 years and erase that conviction for, and the case law is clear, that record sealing is for people who are trying to apply for a job. And it's a fiction that they don't have a conviction anymore, and they can answer no to have you ever been arrested or convicted. But it does nothing to the Second Amendment right. The Second Amendment right is forever abrogated. We've rebutted this presumption. This is, again, and we're only asking for a very narrow application. I don't think this is going to open the doors to jury trials and every type of misdemeanor, because quite frankly, those other misdemeanors would fail a Blanton test. They would fail the Amezcua test. You're talking about most convictions for misdemeanors involve a $1,000 fine. That's not going to be enough. We're only talking about domestic violence, and we're only here because of what the Nevada legislature did in 2015 by making it a crime automatically and immediately. I'm just asking this honorable court to apply the test from Amezcua. That's the language that was used in Amezcua. Direct consequence, automatic and immediate. The moment Mr. Anderson or anyone is found guilty of battery domestic violence, the Second Amendment loss is automatic and immediate. It's fantasy land to suggest, as the city does in their brief, that this involves some sort of future conduct. There's no future conduct. One doesn't have to engage in future conduct to lose their Second Amendment right. The loss is instant.
Counsel argues that the Nevada statute simply mirrored the federal statute. Is there a difference?
The statute, it adopts the federal statute. If I may address it this way.
Is there a material difference between the two statutes to the convicted DV defendant?
Not necessarily, but that doesn't make it any less serious. Again, the inquiry is not what the federal government does, because that's collateral. The inquiry is what the Nevada legislature does.
So if you're writing an opinion that shares your point of view, how does one articulate that consequence as being different? Damascus didn't said it wasn't serious. The federal consequence wasn't serious. It was collateral. So merely because this is a state statute, why does it no longer become collateral and become serious? What's the difference?
The difference,
simply because it's a state statute versus a federal statute.
The key is this, Your Honor, and Blanton says this. Blanton in footnote 8 says you have to look at how the legislature treats it, not how some other states do it, not how the federal government does. Other states, federal government, that's collateral. And Amezcua says that we have to look at what the Nevada legislature did to guns. At the time of Amezcua in 2014, the Nevada legislature had not passed 202.360 to add persons prohibited to the prohibited category for those convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence from possessing firearms. So we have to look at the state statute. And if I could just add one other thing, too. In order for the city to prevail, they have to prove that this is a collateral consequence. And as the court in Amezcua, as this court said, very clearly, you look at, is there judicial discretion? The answer is no. There's no judicial discretion. Mr. Anderson can't go and ask Judge Leung, who sentenced him, hey, can you waive the firearm prohibition that applies to me? No, he can't get any type of judicial discretion. The second issue, like we talked about, was future conduct. It's not about future conduct. It's automatic and immediate. Mr. Anderson doesn't have to do anything in the future to lose his Second Amendment right. And third, there's no administrative discretion. I'm taking this all from Amezcua. And Amezcua says that's an example of where you have some sort of evidence of a collateral consequence. You don't have administrative discretion, justices. You don't, because you can't. Mr. Anderson can't go to Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department and fill out some sort of petition to ask that the Second Amendment abrogation somehow he gets a waiver from it or not apply to him. It's a straightforward application of Amezcua.
Well, the judge doesn't have discretion to deal with the federal consequence either.
Nor the state. If I may interrupt, Your Honor, I apologize for interrupting, but it's this: the judge does not have any power, any discretion to deal with the state statute. So in every domestic violence conviction.
But my point was the judge doesn't have any power to deal with the consequence of the federal statute either.
Correct. That's correct. Federal or state.
Right.
But the fact that.
So why should we treat the federal statute as collateral and the state statute as not? Maybe on that point, MSQS was wrong.
Well, I certainly hope you think MSQ is the correct decision.
Well, it wasn't argued that way, I understand, but it's troubling when you are looking at this to treat a federal statute as a collateral consequence that arrives at the very same result, and a state statute as not collateral and serious when it, too, arrives at the very same result. And it seems to me that looking at this matter from a jurisprudential and academic standpoint, it's very difficult to reconcile those two positions in my mind and be consistent as an appellate court.
I agree, Your Honor. I understand. I was the attorney representing Mr. Amezcua, and that was my argument. Well, he's found guilty at the federal level. He's prosecuted. He's subjected to prosecution. It's a lifelong ban. But this court disagreed and said it's collateral. And so, but then what happened was the Nevada legislature acted. And I'm just asking the court to apply Blanton and Amezcua, because if you apply Blanton and Amezcua and you look at what the Nevada legislature did by automatically and immediately taking away a person's Second Amendment right upon a misdemeanor conviction for battery domestic violence, we've rebutted the presumption that it's petty. You're talking about the Second Amendment, the additional penalty viewed with the maximum term of imprisonment. We've rebutted the presumption. It's such a severe, again, I'm borrowing from Amezcua, it's so onerous. It's so onerous
burden.
But
it's the same thing as the federal statute that Amezcua has talked about. The consequences are the same. The outcome is the same. The permanency deprivation is the same.
But if the fact that the Nevada legislature took it to that level, that they made the law in Nevada that serious to mirror the federal government, that the legislature itself took away a person's Second Amendment right upon a misdemeanor conviction, a fundamental right, that shows legislative intent to treat this as a serious offense.
Okay, you have another minute left. Are you good to go, or do you want to say something else? Or you're over time? Okay.
I thought my buzzer went off, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Okay. It did. Okay. All right.
Well, good job.
All right. Thanks, Your Honor.
I'm glad that my colleagues are watching the clock where I'm supposed to be. Thank you both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted.